3, 2, 1. Hi, this is William Ramsey. Welcome to William Ramsey Investigates. On tonight's show, I have a very special guest. He comes to us from the UK, and he's recently published a book. The beginning of this year, the title of the book is XYZ, The Real Story of How Enigma Was Broken. I've read the book. It's an excellent book, and it provides background into a very important aspect of World War II involving cryptography. And his name may sound familiar. His name is Dermot Turing. He's a relative of Alan Turing, who was featured kind of in a recent movie, The Imitation Game, by starring Benedict Cumberbatch. But Mr. Turing is a prolific author. He has other books. Such titles are The Story of Computing, Prof. Alan Turing Decoded, published 2016, Alan Turing, The Life of a Genius, published 2017. He's also involved in a historical display at the famous Bletchley Park, and that's available to 2028, I believe it's available there. And you can see a lot of the information that he's compiled at his website. It's DermotTuring.com, DermotTuring.com. So, Mr. Turing, are you there?
I'm here, and thank you very much for that very splendid introduction.
Awesome, great. Well, I'm delighted that you agreed to the interview. So, for people who may not know about your background, can you talk a little bit of anything that I might have missed on the intro, and what led you to write this book?
So I'm not a professional historian by background. I spent my career in the legal profession, but the fact of being so closely related to Alan Turing has meant that I've always, for the whole of my life, really had an interest in the Bletchley Park story, and in particular what Alan Turing was doing there. And more recently, I guess, to try and find out a bit more about the backstory to the Bletchley Park story. I think people, certainly those who've seen the movie you referred to, The Imitation Game, will know that Bletchley Park's very famous for having broken the cipher machine that the Germans thought would be unbreakable, the Enigma machine. And Alan Turing's name is very closely associated with that. But I think what's perhaps not quite so well known from that story, and particularly the Hollywood sort of reworking of it, is that there's something sort of quite mysterious about it, which is that right up until the middle of July 1939, so that's just fractionally before war broke out in Europe, and a matter of 6 weeks before war broke out in Europe, the British codebreakers did not know what the wiring inside the Enigma machine was. And without that knowledge, there was no way they were going to break any single message, and certainly no way they were going to invent any amazing technological solution to the Enigma problem. And yet, despite that ignorance, within a matter of weeks after the outbreak of war, the design for Alan Turing's bomb machine, the thing that was going to basically crack the daily problem of how the Enigma machine was set up, that design was already being discussed with the engineers, and it was in the hands of the engineers so that they could start working on the prototype before Christmas of 1939. So we've gone from this rather extraordinary state of perhaps ignorance is an overstatement, but it's certainly a big gaps in the knowledge, right through to having designed a war-winning tool, the bomb machine. And how did that manage to happen quite so quickly? That's a puzzle. And I knew from some of the stuff that I'd read that the Polish code breakers, whoever they were, had something to do with it. They were part of the answer. But it was really, really hard to actually find out anything about this. And I think it's the late Toni Morrison who said, if you can't find a book to read about a subject, then you have to write one. So I guess, gotcha. I found myself in that position personally.
And you had to do a considerable amount of legwork to go and find relatives of many of these Polish, what were military officers who really started off the cryptographic research. Can you talk about your inquiries and gathering that information?
Well, yeah, that was that. You describe it as legwork, but actually, it's rather fun. I was given a great deal of help by the Polish embassy in the UK, who keep in close touch with the code breakers and their families. And the reason they do that is because in Poland, the achievement of the Polish code breakers, very poorly understood, very little known about outside Poland, but in Poland it's a really sort of important part of their national heritage, and so they were very, very helpful in putting me in contact with as many of the families as they knew about, which was great. So I got to meet some very interesting people, and here's where it sort of comes alive, really, is that one of them in particular has got an amazing collection of about 300 photographs taken during the war years of the Polish code breakers. And they're not sitting at desks with pencils and square paper. These are the code breakers doing stuff in their downtime. And so we've got them, playing ball games, curiously playing soccer, wearing suits and ties, which I guess is a bit unusual, but also sort of, going on outings and getting drunk and having parties and that kind of stuff. So, it's great. It meant that what might have been a story about mathematicians and equations actually became a story about people.
Yeah, and I mean, I thought that was an interesting aspect of the book, but the Polish cryptography was very important in the First World War as well. And can you talk a little bit about the people involved in that and how that First World War knowledge went forward towards the beginnings of World War II?
Yeah, so I mean, again, forgive what sort of going to sound a bit like a history lesson, but of course, Poland didn't exist as a country at the outbreak of World War I because it was currently divided between the Austrian, German, and Russian empires. But because both Russia and Austria slash Germany had lost the war at different stages, that meant that there was this opportunity for the Polish state to re-establish itself. And very, very quickly after that, sort of almost immediately after the Polish state was established in November 1918, they had to fight for survival because the Soviet Union decided it wanted to have back the bits of Poland that had been in the Russian Empire. And so this new country had to defend itself, and it very rapidly, and it won, as we know. But part of the reason that it won was that it was able to exploit encrypted Russian radio messages, and that meant that the new head of state, Pilsudski, was very much in the debt to his small team of codebreakers in his military intelligence department. And that meant that throughout the interwar period, the codebreakers were considered to be more of an elite unit rather than in many countries where military intelligence is kind of, if you're not very good on the battlefield, you get sent off to intelligence because you must be useless, and therefore that's the only thing they could think of that was left for you to do.
Right.
And so I hasten to say that I don't believe that attitude prevails in the 21st century armies, either in the United States or in the United Kingdom, but I think it was prevalent 100 years ago.
Right.
But that meant that essentially the World War, or possibly I should say the immediate post-World War I experience, meant that Poland really rated its codebreakers and actually put them onto intelligence challenges right from the get-go.
And they were not only interested in Russia, but also focused towards Germany as well. Many of the early code breakers that you include, whose names was what, Chiesky and Palut, these guys were all kind of focused on Germany. So they were aware of the problems of cryptography from that perspective, from the Polish perspective.
Well, yes, I mean, again, so just looking at Poland's geographical position, it was sort of squeezed between Germany on the West and the Soviet Union on the East. And so it kind of felt to them like they were trapped in a vice. So knowing what the Germans were up to was every bit as important as knowing what the Russians were up to. So, yeah, absolutely. So recruiting bilingual Polish experts who had grown up in the pre-war years in what was German-occupied Polish territory, and therefore had these guys had grown up as bilingual German Polish speakers. You know, they were ideally placed to be recruited by the military intelligence to investigate codes and ciphers.
Right, and they. I think that you wrote in the book that they built the largest radio tower, I think, in Europe at one point, right, to obtain as much information. But can you talk a little bit about that and how they came to...
It was a very strange episode because, I mean, obviously, monitoring radio traffic is not wholly straightforward, and there's all sorts of atmospheric and electrical questions that can interfere with the signal. And so clearly Poland regarded interception as being something that they needed to focus on. And I don't criticize them for that. But what was perhaps completely bizarre was they blew most of their technology budget on this huge radio tower. And that meant that by the time they had actually started making some progress on the Enigma problem, there wasn't really anything left in the budget to build the machinery that they needed to help them with the code breaking. So it was kind of a mixed blessing, that radio tower.
Gotcha. And can you talk about what Enigma was and why it was such a difficult cryptographical nut to crack?
Yeah. I mean, so in World War One, the approach that people had to sort of making codes and ciphers was quite simplistic, if you like. You typically have code books where you'd represent a word or a phrase by a 4 or 5 digit number or sequence of letters, and then you looked it up in a book to work out what the coded sequence meant. And as long as you had the book and the enemy didn't have the book, then everything was fine. Except that the World War One code breakers had managed to rebuild code books without having to capture them. And you just look at the pattern of a sentence that you can work out, you can guess what the next word is going to be from what you've just learned. So book rebuilding was quite well established as a codebreaker's science by, say, 1920. But at that stage, engineering genius came in and said, well, look, we've got a better idea. If we encipher things by switching one letter for another, that can be done by a machine. And what's more, it can be done by a machine that changes the cipher every time you type a new letter. And the way it would change it is by altering the wiring in the machine. It's a bit like operating a laptop keyboard, if you like, where you press an A, but instead of an A coming out on your screen, you'd find a different letter because the wiring has led from A through some complex mechanism that changes it to something else. And they were using a rotor-based device to change the cipher every time you pressed a letter. So every time you press a letter, the rotors move around. That's why you get a different pattern emerging. And so this thing was called the Enigma machine, this cipher machine.
It was,
but of course, the real challenge is that there's so many different ways that the wiring could be configured in the machine. I mean, it's millions and millions, and if you don't know how that's done, then you're not going to be able to break the cipher. That was the security of the machine.
And how did they solve that problem?
Well, there were two problems, essentially. The first one was knowing what the wiring is in the machine, and then the second problem is knowing how the machine's set up every day. So just to try and do you a sort of a description of the Enigma machine, it's got three coding rotors in it, and they can be put in the machine in any in whatever order you like. And obviously, if you've got more than three rotors, then there's many more permutations that you can choose from. you've got to know which way up the rotors are, because they've all got 26 positions, one for each letter of the alphabet. So, you know, it could be A, B, C, D, whatever, that's the uppermost letter. So you've got 17,000 odd permutations for which letter is uppermost. Then there's a thing on the front, which is the keyboard, the plug board, which is another device where you plug in wires to switch one letter for another one. And that would introduce, I think it's 150 million, million different permutations, the ways that can be set up. So that's pretty scary. All of this has been changed every day on every network. So you've not only got to know what the coding rotors do, what the wiring problem is, that's your hardware problem, but you've also got to know how the machine is set up every day, which is kind of like a software problem. And even if you've stolen an Enigma machine or you've somehow reconstructed it, that only helps you with the hardware problem. It doesn't help you with the setup or the software problem. So you've basically got to tackle both of these things in order to be able to read these secret messages.
Right, and that's really it. So they're changing it every 24 hours is the setup, right? I think you wrote in the intro to your book, it's 60
yeah.
septillion possible combinations, so it's an immense
amount. It's a ridiculously large number.
That's 24 zeros after once.
Yeah, it's something, I mean, I can't remember, but there's some comparative statistic about the number of electrons in the universe or something. I mean, it's something, you know, it's a ridiculously large number.
Right, so the interesting thing is that the Poles really started their grind through solving the problem of Enigma very early, much earlier than what would become the French and the English involvement and then the Americans, but... Can you talk about how they kind of addressed this problem leading up to 1939?
Well, yeah, I think we can look at this again in sort of two parts. The first part is a really great spy story about how some guy working in the German cipher office basically had access to the safe and would steal documents out of the safe and he'd get paid by French military intelligence to bring them across so the French guy could photograph them, and then he'd put them back in the safe for Monday morning and thereby not get caught. So there's this whole spy story, which is just, I mean, it's just great. I mean, it's good old-fashioned, Le Carré-style stuff, except that it's real rather than a novel.
Right.
So that's part one of it. But then the question is, what happened to these documents? Well, the Poles and the French had a sort of liaison arrangement. And so when the Poles got hold of these documents, they put their team of German-speaking mathematicians onto trying to figure out what the wiring was in the Enigma machine. And you couldn't figure that out from the documents because the documents were just operating instructions. They weren't technical drawings at all. So what happened was there was one particular mathematician, his name was Marian Rievsky, and he figured out that he could having seen the operating instructions, he could figure out that the Enigma hardware problem was reducible to a set of permutation equations, which is sort of quite remarkable piece of thinking to be able to visualize a machine as a set of equations. And so he wrote down these equations, and then subject to one thing, he knew that he could actually solve them. He'd got, I think, something like six equations and seven unknowns or something, and we all know that you can't solve that. You need to have one of the unknowns revealed to you. Right. But the one unknown that he thought he could guess at was how the wiring in the Enigma machine was linked up from the keyboard to the place that the electricity enters the three rotors. And he thought, and this is just a brilliant psychological insight by Rievsky, that he thought, well, Germans being methodical, they might have used alphabetical order for the connections, and he wasn't wrong, because when he tried that and solved his equations with that assumption in his mind, it all came out, and he was able thereby to reconstruct the wiring in the Enigma machine's rotors, which was, I mean, just as a piece of mathematical analysis, it's sort of mind-blowingly clever. And he'd done that by probably about Easter time of 1932. Hitler wasn't even in power by that stage. You know, I mean, that's quite a remarkable achievement.
And really, the Polish advances were just known to the Polish. It wasn't they weren't working together at that or communicating with each other at that point. So.
No, I mean, that doesn't surprise me at all, because if you think about it, most countries are pretty unwilling to share their hard-won secret intelligence with anybody else. And in the 1930s, most countries switch sides once or twice. In the 1940s, it happened again. So the idea that they were actually going to share this discovery, if you like, with their French allies or anybody else, certainly the British, who were nowhere to be seen, that was just inconceivable. So I'm not in the least bit surprised they didn't tell anybody, but that meant that they were quite happily in a position to create techniques for solving the software problem and then to start reading Enigma messages in the mid-1930s. So by the mid-1930s, they knew exactly what Adolf Hitler and his armed forces were preparing to do.
Right, so they were gearing, seeing these movements and the Anschluss and all these events probably made them nervous, and I led them to reach out. And can you talk about how they reached out to the French and how the knowledge of the Enigma got spread around to other countries?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Poles were very keen to keep the whole success story under wraps for the reasons I just mentioned. But the French and the British the French had been very alive to the threat of Nazi Germany for some time. The British sort of woke up to the issue rather late. But by 1938, both the French and the British were effectively stymied by the Enigma problem. They were clueless about the wiring, and yet they knew that this was the way that the Germans were going to conceal their secret messages if war broke out. So they kind of needed to make some progress on it. And it was the French, because of their liaison with the Poles, the French suggested that the three countries should get together and share know-how on the problem. And I think the guy in charge of the French effort, a chap called Gustave Bertrand, I think that Bertrand must have suspected that the Poles had made more progress than they were letting on. And the way that he went about setting up the meeting kind of confirmed his suspicions, because of the way the Poles reacted to his overture. But the upshot of it was that they started a series of three-party conferences, which began in early 1939. By the time they got to the second of these conferences, the Poles, you know, they had Hitler, just being about as aggressive as it's possible to be on their doorstep, and they also had this problem that we talked about earlier, that they'd blown all their technology budget on this huge radio mast, and they needed to ramp up their engineering capability to solve the Enigma in the form that it existed in early 1939. So I think that by that stage they realized that they could probably trade the Enigma secret for cooperation, both military cooperation with the French and engineering cooperation with the British. And so they actually told the Brits and the French everything they knew in July 1939, which was the answer to my problem I began with, which is how come the Brits managed to get from this state of what I call ignorance to building this amazing piece of machinery in such a short time? And the answer is because the Poles told them everything they wanted to know. It's the most extraordinary thing, because you really don't expect people to share their hard-won secrets.
And this is how you came up with the title of your book. So the references or the codes for the three parties were X for Paris, Y London, Z Warsaw. So you get the XYZ.
Yeah, and that was the French. The French who said we're going to use these code letters to perhaps keep more secure our communications. I'm not convinced that was a particularly effective strategy, but okay, it might. It's kind of cool in the code breaking context that they decided to do that.
Right, the code. Then how was this? Can you talk about Knox and some of these other Brits and how they got advantages and how Turing got involved in the whole Enigma project?
Yeah, so the British, I mean, one of the great things about this voyage of discovery has been learning about a whole bunch of really quite eccentric folk. But so you mentioned Knox. Knox was a veteran of the World War One code-breaking team that the British had, and by the time of the Spanish Civil War, mid-1930s, he'd been put onto the emerging Enigma problem, and he'd made some progress. There's more than one version of the Enigma machine, and the simpler versions, he was able to find techniques for breaking them, which was a pretty amazing achievement. When he went to go and see this, go to this conference I mentioned, where the Poles actually revealed everything that they knew, because Knox thought he was the world expert on Enigma, he was completely appalled to discover that the Poles knew the answer to every single question. And not only that, but they knew more than he did. And it was kind of like, you know, having somebody lean over your shoulder and fill in the crossword puzzle for you just when you're about to make your own breakthrough. He was absolutely disgusted by this and threw his toys out of the cot and threatened to boycott the meeting. And this was like just at the point where the Poles were about to tell even more information. And so he nearly kind of jeopardized the whole info sharing deal, which was a disaster. But fortunately, he calmed down by the second day and they got everything they wanted to know. So he comes back to the UK. And the code-breaking unit, which was then called the Government Code and Cipher School, had started hiring some professor types from, in particular from Cambridge, but also from Oxford. And amongst those professor types was this man called Alan Turing, which was a very unusual kind of a hire for them because he was a mathematician, and the code breakers kind of thought that code breaking was a linguistic problem, and therefore you should be hiring classicists and language professors, not really mathematicians. But because in the Enigma problem was a mechanical one, they kind of thought that mathematicians might be able to contribute something to it, so they indoctrinated Alan Turing into the Enigma problem quite early in 1939. And so when Knox comes back to the UK armed with all this knowledge that he's just learned from the Poles, he sits down with Alan Turing and they start working on the Enigma problem together in earnest. And so that's really when Alan Turing's involvement with the Enigma starts to take off. And as I mentioned, it's only a matter of, by this stage, it's war breaks out only 4 or 5 weeks later. So from that point on, they're all transferred physically to Bletchley Park, which is the war station. And they're working on the problem, you know, full time from that point on.
Turing was relatively young at the time, 27 years old, but his famous paper had been published 3 years before. It was on computable numbers, right? So he had this foundation of not just math, but also the idea of using mechanical or machines to help in solving mathematical problems. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think that all started, you mentioned his paper, but I think after he'd written that paper, he came and spent 2 years at Princeton. And I think while he was there, he was very focused on practical applications of, problem solving through machinery. And so he actually spent some time sneaking off to one of the engineering laboratories at Princeton and actually trying to make machines to do things. I mean, he built himself a multiplication machine. I don't know how it worked, but one of the things he did while he was there. So he was quite focused on not just the sort of very esoteric equation solving, but the mechanical devices for taking the drudgery out of routine mathematical processes.
Right, and wasn't he the one who distilled all kind of machine thinking down to a byte, a zero, or a one? Wasn't that kind of his insight, or is that not correct?
I would hesitate to sort of say that's somehow his idea. I mean, certainly he was quite conscious that all mathematical propositions could be represented as a string of ones and zeros. That's the sort of essence of the thing called the Turing machine, which was in his paper on computable numbers that you mentioned. So yes, I mean that it's at the heart of that. Whether he's the first to have come up with the idea that propositions could be represented in that way, I don't know. But he certainly realized that binary was a useful way of representing both numbers and concepts to so that they could be processed in this mechanical way. I mean, it would certainly be wrong to say that he invented binary. I mean, but that wasn't what he was saying.
I just like at the application of binary. But he, when really the invasion of Poland happened, a lot of things changed. And can you talk a little bit about how these crypto analysts kind of made their way to the West?
Yeah, so we've got this bunch of Polish mathematicians who, really the Enigma whizzes. When Poland got invaded, they very rapidly lost the war with Germany, and it didn't help that they were invaded pretty much simultaneously by the Soviet Union as well under the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. So the Polish codebreakers, along with chunks of the Polish army, escaped from Poland and reconstituted themselves in France. The codebreakers got essentially rescued by Gustave Bertrand, the French guy I was telling you about earlier, and joined his French codebreaking unit just outside Paris as soon as they got to France. And so what they were able to do is basically continue the codebreaking fight against Germany by becoming part of the French codebreaking team that was still liaising with the British. So we recreated that sort of XYZ. I'm talking to an American audience. XYZ triangle was reconstituted, notwithstanding the defeat of Poland, which was, that was pretty productive. In the early part of 1940, the three teams together were producing intelligence based on the Enigma decrypts that they were able to read, which should have helped the French when France got invaded by Germany. There was just a bit of a problem getting the French military to wake up to what they were being told.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's an interesting part of the book on chapter 7 where you talk about how the Enigma was actually covered up and called Boniface or Boniface, and so even the high command didn't really, or the general staffs of France and Britain didn't really warm up to what they were being told.
Yeah, well, this was the problem, that everybody was so hyper-secret about the source of this special kind of intelligence that they didn't want the knowledge that we could read enemy codes and ciphers to fall into the wrong hands. So they came up with a cover story that this priceless stuff was being produced by a spy called Boniface, or spelt Boniface, but I think they pronounced it Boniface in Britain anyway. But of course, military men are not stupid, and they realized that, well, anything that's come from a human source is likely to have a degree of unreliability. And some of the stuff that was coming out of signals intelligence was so different from what they were themselves expecting that they thought, well, you know, frankly, this spy, he obviously just doesn't know what he's talking about. Which obviously wasn't true, because it was the spy was the enemy himself. But right. But they didn't know that. So I think, yes, you're right. I think they can be forgiven for not reacting quite as well as they should have done. I mean, all that changed after the intelligence departments got understood better how to package their product. Then they let some of the senior generals in and admirals in on the secret, and so it was therefore given a much higher degree of weighting and credibility than it had before.
Yeah. And the Bertrand you mentioned, I think he wrote or said that he had been feeding sweets to swine. So I thought that was interesting. And Ian Fleming kind of pops up at that time. But on the subject of secrecy, much of this story was kept secret for a variety of reasons. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Clearly it was appropriate to keep it secret even after the end of World War II. Not just that there had been code-breaking successes, but most particularly the knowledge about how the Allies had gone about breaking codes, because that was still of, particularly as we entered into the Cold War phase, then that was still very current knowledge and of great importance from a sort of national security perspective. So I fully understand that if you left Bletchley Park or you left one of the US code-breaking agencies, on pain of death, you had to keep the secret. But secrets have this sort of habit of not remaining secrets forever. And I think dribs and drabs of information started coming out in the 1960s and 1970s about the fact that, during World War II, we might actually have been able to break German and Japanese ciphered messages. And eventually the balloon just burst with the publication of a book by a guy called Frederick Winterbottom in the UK, who had an association with Bletchley Park, though he was actually an intelligence officer rather than a code breaker. When his book came out, there was a huge sensation that Bletchley Park had broken German codes, and in particular broken the Enigma cipher machine. And once that genie was out of the lamp, then it was kind of impossible to get it back in again. What was really bizarre, though, is how the British and American authorities reacted to this. And they were kind of in denial about some of it. And they said, well, OK, now it's known what happened, then we can release people from their oath of secrecy, but to the extent that all they do is just say that they were at Bletchley Park, and they can now be proud of their service. But that was kind of a bit weird, because there were some people like Gordon Welshman, who was Alan Turing's collaborator on the bomb machine. He was in the US and he wanted to write his memoirs. He was in his mid-70s at the time. And he wrote his story of his experiences at Bletchley Park. And that included explaining how the Enigma problem had actually been solved. Now, he's doing this in 1983 or 84.
Okay.
The war's been over for 40 years. Nobody's been using an Enigma machine since time immemorial, and yet he is sent what feels like a school report by the head of GCHQ saying, you ought to know better. And he's had his US security clearance removed. I mean, this is a guy in his 70s. I mean, it's completely bizarre. He's had his security clearance removed for talking about something that has been obsolete for decades. And I find that, I still find that sort of very peculiar and difficult to understand.
It seems odd. I mean, when you wrote in your book, these people had to acknowledge the Official Secrets Act. And I think that was in perpetuity, right? There's no time
yes.
limit.
No time limit. But, you know, the way the Welshman was sort of hounded at the end of his life seems to me to be, grossly unfair, because this is a guy that ought to have been given a medal for being a national hero.
Right. And it seems like the untold story of Alan Turing has probably only been publicly recognized for the last two decades, if that.
I think that's probably right, yeah.
I mean, it's pretty remarkable. We are at 40 minutes, Dermot. Do you have anything else you'd like to cover or anything that we missed? I mean, congratulations on the book. It's a superb book.
Well, it's kind of you to say that. I think the one thing that I hadn't really quite expected when I embarked upon this mission was to discover that there was this extraordinary sort of Le Carre-esque kind of spy story component to it. And I'd imagined that writing about code breaking would be sort of quite dry and a bit technical, and to discover that actually it's about people being robbed at gunpoint on mountain passes in the middle of winter, and it's about people smuggling documents over borders, wrapping them in greaseproof paper around salamis, I mean, that kind of stuff I'd never expected to come across in this, and it's great fun. So I hope that the story is appealing to people who may think that code breaking is something for, mathematicians and boffins.
Great. And again, your website is DermotTuring.com, DermotTuring.com. The title of the book, again, is XYZ, The Real Story of How Enigma Was Broken, and it was selected as one of the best books by Nature in 2018. So again, Dermot Turing, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right. Have a great day.